This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of Every Day a Miracle, Trusting the God Who Heals Us Inside and Out. Written and narrated by Matthew Stephen Brown and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing. I want to get into it, man, you know. Like, you know I'm the man, don't you? Can I count it off? 1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Ware and Justin Gibney, where you can get in-depth political analysis from a Christian worldview. Transcend partisanship and political ideology with us as we seek true discipleship in the public square.
This is the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Ware and Justin Gibney, brought to you by the AND Campaign. Justin, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, man. I had a pretty good weekend. I got to preach at the Commons LA. So shout out to the Commons, some really great people. And it's interesting, you know, we usually start this conversation off by talking about some sports. And after I gave my sermon, one of the first questions I got from the folks at Commons LA was, how did I feel about the Lakers being up 2-0? And this is a church event, you know what I mean? We gotta take it there, right? But now they're great people. I had a good time. But as Providence would have it, we know what happens Sunday night. So hopefully the Heat can get a little bit of momentum and keep it going.
That's right. And, you know, I'm not going to, like, you know, pontificate here. But, you know, speaking of Providence, folks can just check out, you know, the score line from yesterday and see how the Buffalo Bills. I mean, maybe they lost. Maybe they won their fourth in a row. You know, if folks can see that for themselves, you know, do your own research is kind of what I say. But
look, I'm not a Bills hater, so I'm gonna give you your props that they're looking pretty good out there, man. And yeah, maybe we should do an episode so people can understand where I'm coming from more on the history of my Laker hate and where it came from. I think that might help people understand me a little better on this subject.
And it's important for people to know too. I think they'll get deep into your psyche, understand so much more. Yeah, hey, in 4 weeks and a day, things are going to open up. We could do episodes about all kinds of things, right. But for the next 4 weeks, we got kind of our calendar is set a bit by the fact that politics is going to be driven quite a bit by this presidential election. We had our first debate last week between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. There's been a lot of conversation about the debate. Justin, you know, there's so much we could say, but would just love to start with, should we be having presidential debates? There's so much cynicism about debates generally, and I don't think what happened last week did much to dissuade those who are cynical about these things. Why is it important that we have presidential debates? What's supposed to be the value of them to the American people and to the political process?
Yeah, that's a good question, Michael. And I think I've mentioned it before that, you know, not only did I letter in a few sports in high school, but also lettered in debate. So I have long had a great appreciation for the value of a good, sound debate, an adversarial but civil debate, because debate plays such an important role in the discourse of a republic. Dictators rarely are going to debate. Right. Demagogues usually try to avoid debate in a controlled environment because they just want to appeal to the passions. They don't really want to get into all the substance and have to defend anything. They often don't want a clear examination of the merits. And that's honestly, and I'm not going in the direction of saying Trump is a dictator or any of that stuff, but that's honestly how President Trump acted last week. Biden did not have a great debate. He threw out some insults that were probably unnecessary, but Trump was clearly just out of control. Now, what debates are supposed to be, getting to your question, they're supposed to be an opportunity to hear the candidates address one another's ideas, their qualifications, and their past actions. We talk about this in detail in the book. And again, I would recommend that everybody get our new book, Compassion and Conviction, The AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement. But we talk about how philosopher Richard J. Burke believed that American politics was best understood as rhetoric. He argued that in America, we gain influence through symbols and communication that are conscious attempts to persuade. We operate by persuasion, not compulsion. Persuasion, when we're trying to persuade people and not compel them, we're doing two different things, right? Compelling someone and persuading them are very different. According to Burke, persuasion risks the failure to persuade. And thus, by risking the failure to persuade, it recognizes the freedom of other people to make up their minds. That is essential to democracy. But I would have to say, Michael, that sadly, many of our leaders, many of our tribes don't want to persuade anymore. They just want to compel, right? This is why we hear people always saying that they have to control every branch of government to get anything done. We have to get rid of the filibuster. We have to pack the court. We have to yell obscenities. We have to call people out of their names because we're unwilling or incapable of persuading others. So many partisan efforts today are aimed at cutting off the debate rather than honestly and diligently engaging the debate. We hear all this ridiculous stuff about what your identity has to be in order to be part of this particular debate, what particular words you have to say to be heard. We now define all arguments that we don't like as violence because we don't want to have to go through the rigors of persuading. And we use all kinds of vindictive and manipulative devices to discredit our opponents again, so we don't really have to engage their ideas in earnest. And I think Christians should reject this trend. This is the opposite of what Christians like Frederick Douglass and Catherine Boone were about. They did not hide from debate. They went to the debate. They wanted to debate the people on the other side of them. Frederick Douglass didn't say, because slaveholders are bad people, I don't want to have to debate them. He wanted to debate them because the merits of the case were on his side. And we should always run to those kind of conversations because they give us a chance to show that the other person is wrong. If they're wrong, then prove it. I would encourage folks to look up the Lincoln-Douglass debates of 1858. This was between Abraham Lincoln, Honest Abe, who would later become president, and Stephen Douglas, who they called the Little Giant. And they engaged in a series of debates as they fought for the Illinois U.S. Senate seat. They were debating about the extension of slavery in light of the Missouri Compromise and the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Lincoln was against the extension. While Douglas supported it and had proposed legislation to further that position based on the doctrine of popular sovereignty. And basically what popular sovereignty was the idea that the settlers in each state should be able to decide whether slavery would be legal in their territories. And that shouldn't be a decision by Congress, but it should be a decision again by the settlers. Now, the formats of these debates were different. But the purpose was generally the same, and it's what the purpose should have been last week. It was supposed to be a debate about policy and defending your premise. The point was to give people a deeper understanding of your philosophical basis, of practical considerations that you've made, and of the strength of your conclusions. We got none of that last week, Michael. We got loud, personal, and most times unfounded attacks, constant interruptions, especially by the president, and then a refusal to unequivocally condemn white supremacy. Now, when we said something about this at the AND campaign, there were people saying that he's already said it before. Maybe so. Maybe he has already said it. So I'll give you voice on that. But that's an opportunity, if you've already said it, to be even more clear and to almost use that against them, the fact that they would even bring that up. But what we heard was equivocation. What we heard were some other words that were not a clear rejection of white supremacy, And we also didn't get a statement. I mean, at least I didn't see here a clear statement afterwards. I mean, that's something you can easily clear up and be, and nobody should ever have to wonder about it or ask you that again. I mean, if you really were that serious, and we know things, we'll talk about what happened after the debates, a couple of days after the debate. But that's an opportunity to have a press conference where you're standing there and calling people out for even making that suggestion. That could have really backfired if you handled it the right way, but that's not what happened. And so I really want my 2 or so hours back from that debate, because it was not at all what a presidential debate should be. It was beneath the office. I don't think either side did great. And I don't understand why people were mad at the moderator. I don't know what they wanted him to do. I mean, how many times can he remind people to stop interrupting? I don't know if he could have silenced the mic or whatever, but outside of that, I don't know what folks wanted him to do. If somebody is debating and they're going to act in that manner, it's very hard to keep them in line unless you're going to physically restrain them. But I'll pass it to you. I just want people to know, our audience to know, why these debates are important and why we should be listening. Even if we've made up our minds, we should know what the candidates are saying and thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought about this before, but you know, what a metaphor, what a microcosm of this last season in American politics for, you know, folks to be asking why, you know, little Chris Wallace didn't rein in the leader of the free world, you know, like I mean, what was clear is, to the extent that there was a strategy at all, the strategy was to provoke chaos. The strategy was to prevent Biden an opportunity of sort of breaking through. Biden tried speaking, you know, you could tell when Trump was like interrupting and sort of causing a scene, there would be these moments where Biden would try to look directly into the camera and talk directly to the American people. And I think that was planned. I think that was a strategy. The problem is just the audio was just so distracting that you couldn't hear what Biden was saying as he looked directly into the camera and tried to talk about sort of kitchen table issues. And Justin, your setup was apt. I mean, for things like presidential debates, and it's why the white supremacy question was asked, for things like presidential debates, you have people tuning in who aren't watching politics every day for the last, you know, three and a half years. Presidential debates are for the American people generally, who, you know, may not be able to read the newspaper every day, but know a presidential election is important, know that they only have a few opportunities to hear the candidates together. And that's why you see tens of millions of people watching the debates, because they're trying to do what we urge people to do all the time, which is, with the opportunities that you have, with the time that you have, take your civic responsibility seriously. And I'm afraid that those watching the debate took their civic responsibility more seriously than the folks who participated. It's a sad thing. It's a sad thing. There, I saw a video of a college professor apologizing to her students for telling them to watch the debate for class credit. I mean, in some ways, Justin, it is better than had the debate presented an alternative reality from what we've had for for the last 3.5 years. Like, if the American people have a choice, if they want that, then they could elect that. if they want sort of chaos and sort of self-aggrandizing sort of confusion, then they could have that. And if not, they could choose something else. And they could discern to what extent Joe Biden was responsible for that or not, to what extent Chris Wallace was responsible for that or not, and to what extent President Trump was responsible for what happened on the debate stage. And by that, you know, the last, you know, 3.5 years. To your point about sort of the president's comments on white supremacy. And kind of, I just want to drill down a bit deeper here. I alluded to this before, but the reason the question is asked is because a presidential debate is a clear opportunity. Joe Biden said that he ran because of Charlottesville, which President Trump rolled his eyes about, by the way, when Chris Wallace said that. So President Trump doesn't take Biden at his word that that's why he got in the race. But then 30 seconds later, he reaffirmed why Biden's reason for getting in the race by not being able to, for the American public, not in just some press conference after the press conference in which he was unable to condemn white supremacy during Charlottesville, but on one of the most significant stages that a president will have during an election, during a debate, Chris Wallace gave him a softball. He gave him an opportunity to clearly, unequivocally condemn white supremacy, would have shut down so much of what sort of the media elite and liberals on Twitter are saying. I mean, imagine Trump folks being able to send around that video of Trump just saying, absolutely, these people have been lying to you about where I stand. These people have contorted things for their sort of political interests, but I want you, the American people, and especially Black Americans, I want to speak to you directly and say that I have and always will condemn white supremacy. Here's how I've combated it through the FBI and Department of Homeland Security. Here are the policies I've advanced. But he didn't do that. That's on him. that's on him. And so, Justin, it was. I agree. I don't think it was an edifying debate for the American people who deserve to hear from both candidates about how politics, how their administrations would affect their well-being. And that didn't happen. I'm interested to see, you know, I think I would expect for a more coherent debate, at least between Pence and Harris. I mean, I'll be honest. I have concerns on the Harris side for this Wednesday. So we'll see how that turns out. But I think the American people will at least have an ability to follow the debate this Wednesday. So I hope folks tune into that. It might be the only opportunity you have to hear sort of complete sentences without folks speaking over and some policy detail.
I mean, it can't get any worse, right?
Right.
Maybe that's a bright spot that it can only go up from
here.
But let me say this too. I think, the only strategy that I saw coming from the president was to just kind of overwhelm the whole debate with interruptions and
that's a good way to put it.
And all that stuff. I mean, that's all that I saw. And we talked about why that is beneath what debate is about and the process and the discourse in general. But I think it actually, at the end of the day, he had a number of opportunities that he missed because he was just talking over him, you know, because he didn't even give him a chance to answer. To your point on the white supremacy, you knocked that out the park. I mean, you shame anybody who's made that suggestion and you call them out as clearly as possible. That's actually an opportunity to score some points, right? But that didn't happen. And then Biden had some vulnerabilities. I mean, when you're talking about the race issue, Trump could have said, well, look, your own vice president's election called you a racist. What are you going to do about that? He couldn't do that. He couldn't get that out because he was too busy just throwing these little shots and not letting Biden talk. And we know sometimes the more that Biden talks, the more he is prone to gaffes. So if you really have a good strategy, you let him talk. And then after he talks, you find something to attack. I mean, let's be serious. I mean, it didn't look like there was any preparation. All kinds of missed opportunities. You know, Biden also, his response in regard to Antifa was bad. Trump didn't really even attack that because he wasn't really paying attention. He wasn't really trying to have a real debate. And I would just say this at the end of the day, you put it right, Michael. It was not edifying. Nothing was gained from it. And there was little consideration of the suffering people in America and why they need to hear some answers and plans.
Right. Exactly.
Debates are important because these leaders will be making decisions for hurting and suffering people.
Yes.
And we didn't get any of that.
Yeah. I mean, the, you know, the one thought I'd had, you know, so in 2012, Barack Obama went into his first debate with Mitt Romney and struggled mightily. And the reason for that was when you're, and this doesn't happen ever, but the reason why it happened to Barack Obama in 2012 is when you're president, you're just not used to being challenged, especially face to face in that way. And you're not used to not having the people around you sort of take what you're saying at sort of at, like you mean it. And so if folks rewatch that debate or just remember it, I mean, Mitt Romney wiped the floor with Barack Obama. And so, you know, there's a potential here that well, you know, I kind of can't say this with a straight face, but there's an opportunity if Trump sees clear numbers of so the polling post debate has shown that people think Biden won the debate, not a majority but a plurality. I think I've seen numbers like 38% think Biden won, 11% think Trump did. You know, there's a chance Trump sees these numbers and thinks, gosh, I really need to rebound. I really need to handle things differently in debates 2 and 3. And you know, that'll be interesting to see if he sort of reconfigures his approach. But
And I would also mention, just for those people, you mentioned a very good debate and one that's worth looking back at. One debate that sticks out to me that people don't talk about a lot is a Dick Cheney and John Edwards debate, where I expected John Edwards to win. I mean, this dude was a trial lawyer.
Right.
Dick Cheney destroyed John. And I don't agree with very much many things from Dick Cheney. He destroyed John. His posture was kind of treating him like a child, like he didn't know anything he was talking about. And it was wildly, it was one of the best debate performances I have seen, even though it's not somebody I agreed a whole lot with. Dick Cheney destroyed him. So you may want to go look at that if you're interested in these type of debates.
Man, I may look at that. John Edwards was one of the first politicians that, you know, captured my attention. And then, yeah, I mean, I do remember Dick Cheney mopping the floor with him. I need to rewatch that. That's a good idea. All right, let's take a break. When we get back, we'll talk about the news concerning President Trump's health and several folks in the administration. We'll talk about that when we get back. This is the Church Politics Podcast.
This episode is brought to you in part by Matthew 5-9 Fellowship, who supports evangelical pastors and leaders in shepherding their communities to live the gospel and place their identity in Jesus Christ above partisanship and societal divisions. Jesus has called his disciples to be peacemakers, and that call is particularly needed in our often toxically polarized society. The Matthew 5-9 Fellowship provides resources to help pastors, leaders, and their communities faithfully navigate difficult issues without dividing over them. It fosters relationship by connecting like-minded evangelical leaders across the country. Also, they care about the personal well-being of pastors and leaders, so they provide space and opportunities to experience spiritual renewal to ensure leaders flourish both privately and publicly. A polarized country needs a peacemaking church. Check us out at Matthew59.org, sign up for our monthly newsletter, and download free resources such as our Transcending Toxic Polarization booklet using the code Matthew59.
All All right, we're back. This is the Church Politics Podcast. Justin, Friday news broke that some folks are calling it an October surprise, which refers to the fact that in presidential elections, there's this expectation that, something will happen that sort of changes things. I think I'd say there are political implications to this, but at first it's a health issue related to the leader of the free world, the person who sits in the Oval Office. Donald Trump tested positive for COVID. Sort of the way the narrative played out was sort of the idea that Hope Hicks, who's White House aide, tested positive for COVID. Obviously, I haven't seen anything that's conclusive that Hope Hicks is the person who got it first, but we've since, I think I saw A.G. Barr has tested positive for COVID. Governor Chris Christie, who was in debate prep with Donald Trump. And so a number of folks have contracted COVID in President Trump's circle so far. Joe Biden has tested negative, although he's been tested regularly. I mean, I think the most important thing here is Trump is not the only world leader to have contracted COVID. Boris Johnson, the PM in the UK, had COVID. It is something serious that goes beyond politics for the leader of the free world, especially when he's at Mr. Trump's age and all these things. When that kind of vulnerability, and I'm not making a electoral point here. I want you to hear me. I want folks, listeners, to hear me. I'm making a policy. This is something that countries can take advantage of. And so for that reason, for the fact that President Trump is a human being, for the fact that he has a family and he has responsibilities, I'm praying that that President Trump gets well soon, that he doesn't have serious complications from this. And then there are all these foreign policy, political implications. And then lower than that, there are electoral implications. And that's what a lot of the press has focused on. President Trump was sent to Walter Reed. There are reports he'll be able to go home. We're recording this on Monday, but yesterday, on Sunday, President Trump did take a little motorcade, and supporters had camped out in front of Walter Reed. And there's been some criticism of the fact that he potentially exposed whoever was driving him in that car to COVID, and that it just wasn't a good message for folks who have had to be shut in. Regular Americans have had to be shut in who've had COVID, and President Trump has been diagnosed for 3 days at that time, and was sort of making press stops and saying hello to fans. What does it mean that Trump has contracted COVID? What have you thought of the response generally from the public? But what have you thought of some of the response from the left that we've seen to this?
Yeah. Well, let me start by saying this. I think, from the AND campaign, we will pray for our leaders. It's not our wish to see anybody pass away. And so we will be praying for the president for his recovery. And we think we see that as a biblical mandate. And that's where we stand as an organization on it. And some of the responses that I've seen, the I told you so's and the this is what he gets. I hope it's worse than they're saying it is. It just shows that we cannot put politics down. We cannot see past this election. And it's really sad, because when you can't see past an election, when you can't see someone's humanity past any of the issues that you might have with them, it just says that we're in a bad place. And I don't, once I heard that announcement, I think we all could expect, especially on Twitter, it was to be expected. You even had people saying, to feel sorry for this is to, enable him in some way. Like you're supporting one of his policies because you don't want his son to lose his father. So some of that's expected. I think it's incumbent on all of us to call stuff like that out and say, no, that's not the way we have to do this. We have an election, guys, right? let the election decide. We don't need to wish that kind of stuff on people right now. So that's my, you know, that's my point of view on it. It's clear that the president is still doing a lot of performative stuff to show power, right? This issue compromised his narrative and compromised his I'm strong, Biden's weak, right? So he's afraid that he's going to appear weak. And so he's doing all these things, putting other people in harm's way because he wants to show that he's strong. He's got to let that go. First of all, have the consideration for others who have to drive you around and do all that stuff because it's their job and they have families to go home to. Have consideration for them. Have consideration for your own family. And, you know, the facade of strength, especially at this moment, is just gone. So you're going to have to find some other way to do it. And I think it does, you know, it does point to a failure of leadership on this issue that this even happened in this way. Because you're in a position where every precaution could be taken. So while we will pray for his full recovery and everything else that can be taken care of during the vote, it does compromise even more so just, you know, the leadership that's been shown when it comes to COVID. I was disappointed in what progressives were saying, but I wasn't surprised. And I think Christians just have to make sure that we don't fall into that. Again, our view of society, our view of civic engagement cannot be based on Trump, whether we support him or dislike him. Our opponents cannot be the center of our public witness. And the person you should support cannot be the center of your public witness. And I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, no, let me pick up there. I listen, you had a great conversation with our brother, our friend Esau McCauley on his podcast. And you said several things on that podcast that stuck out to me. And we weren't planning on talking about this, but I'm going to ask you anyways. You said that you made a commitment that your public witness was not going to be Trump-centered. Can you talk, Esau, it was a great interview. I would encourage folks to listen to it. Both of y'all said some really insightful things there. Esau didn't press you too much on that. Could you just talk a little bit? I mean, I think this segment's a good opportunity to speak to that. Why make, I mean, he's right. So some might say he's the president of the United States. Politics does revolve around him. Why would you make a commitment that your witness was not going to be Trump-centered?
Yeah, it's a good question. What I meant by that was, look, there are a lot of folks, Republicans and Democrats, that their every response, their everything that they say that's political has to do with whether it helps Trump or hurts Trump. And especially, you know, the people that we know that don't like Trump, they really have an expectation of the AND campaign that anytime we talk about politics, anything we mention, every time we post, it needs to be aimed at hurting Trump. And if it doesn't hurt Trump, then we don't care, right? That we don't see what's going on. We don't see the issues with him if everything we do isn't aimed at hurting Trump. And for many Republicans, you know, when you evaluate another politician, when you look at a policy, it's like people are looking at whether or not what they say is going to help him. So I'm not going to admit you're right. I'm not going to admit that somebody else was wrong unless it helps Trump or unless it hurts Trump. And I think that the AND campaign and you and me who do have people looking to us for a solid and faithful kind of evaluations and assessments of what's going on in politics, we do them a huge disservice if everything we say is based on what we think about Trump. There is so much more to our public witness than what Trump is doing. Who he is and the position he is in is very important. Don't get me wrong about that. I'm not saying ignore it or act like there's not a reason to be very passionate about either supporting or going against him. What I'm saying is it's not everything. That there's so much more to your public witness. And if we're going to rise above this moment, somebody has to have the moral imagination to say, hey, things could be different. And there's other things, whether it's the local, whether it's cultural, there's other things that we have to be paying attention to as well, because this will end, whether you support them or not. This will end at some time. And you don't want your witness from this time.
Yeah.
Exactly. You don't want your entire witness from this moment to be about whether you supported him or not. People can know you should be. I'm not saying hide it. I'm just saying, is your whole witness about that really?
Hey, that's a. I really wanted you to be able to speak to that, and I think one of the benefits it has is that when we do speak directly about things pertaining to this president, people know that's not fabricated, that we're not straining to, straining gnats, but they know that the center of the AND campaign is elsewhere. And it's from that ground that we're speaking about Trump or Biden or anybody else. And hopefully folks can take it as an earnest, genuine assessment when you do get the sense that there's some folks out there, they may be able to rile folks up, but there's also this in the back of folks' mind, this idea that they don't really mean this. This is a cool slam line, but they don't really mean with any conviction what they're saying. They're just trying to get at this political figure that I don't like. All right.
And why would you give someone that much control over your public witness, right? Why would you give them the control that every time they do something, you have to react in a certain way? It just doesn't make a lot of sense. Again, we're not saying don't address it. It'd be hard to say that the AND campaign hasn't addressed it. That's not the point. But are you centering it? I would suggest that you not do that.
Yeah, that's good. Let's we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk about some new actions from Governor Greg Abbott in Texas related to the vote. This is the Church Politics Podcast. All right, we're back. This is the Church Politics Podcast. Let me read you the opening of this article from the Texas Tribune. The headline is Governor Greg Abbott limits counties to one absentee ballot drop-off location, bolstering GOP efforts to restrict voting. The lead paragraph here, Governor Greg Abbott threw the weight of his office Thursday behind Republican efforts to limit options for Texas voters who want to hand deliver their completed absentee ballots for the November election, a rebuke to some large Democratic counties that have set up multiple drop-off locations in what they call an effort to maximize voter convenience. The Republican governor issued a proclamation directing counties to designate just one location for ballot drop-offs and allowing political parties to install poll watchers to observe the process. Justin, this isn't, the most egregious sort of thing we've ever seen. But I will say, it is yet another example of elected officials put into office by the process of voting, taking actions that put up obstacles to people voting that, in my view, undermine people's ability to trust the civic process, as opposed to doing what they should be doing, which is making it easier for people to vote, making it clearer the voice that the American people have, and in this case, Texans have in their elections. And it just has to stop. I mean, we talk in Compassion and Conviction about the way that voting and voting rights is tied to, amongst other things, it is the clearest example of public input into our democracy, which public input into a democratic form of government is a pretty important piece. But we also talk about the way that voting rights is tied to civility and the expectation that people will channel their frustrations through the political process, when in history, many times political frustrations get channeled through other means because the political process can't be trusted. Again, this isn't the first sort of action that we've seen in recent years that give the impression and in my estimation that actually do make it harder for people to vote. What do you think about all of this? What is the responsibility that elected officials have in this regard? And what responsibility do we have as citizens?
No, that's a good question. I think this is just unfortunate and completely unnecessary. You know, to say that the counties can't provide more than one drop-off location, and then to say that this was about the integrity of the elections, to stop voter fraud, and then provide no evidence. See, this is the big, you know, you don't play with voter rights. Like, we know people have died about this. You don't play about voting rights. You shouldn't ever do things that can make it harder for people to vote, especially a month out from the election, given American history and for how long people have been disenfranchised. You don't play with that. Something happened similar here in Georgia a few years back, where you're making up these rules. You're doing things that limit people's ability. And even if it's not something that completely stops somebody that's very determined to vote from voting, why are you doing it? Why are you doing it if you can't have strong, if you can't show strong evidence of voter fraud? Why are you doing it? And then you complain that people are unfairly saying that you don't want people to vote. I thought Abbott was better than this. I don't know what kind of pressure he gave into. I don't know how this happened, but this isn't just bad PR, right? It seems undemocratic, especially in a state that looks like it's beginning to be a toss-up. And then you do this in counties, especially you're targeting counties where there's a lot of black voters. You got to stay away from that stuff. It's not okay. It should not be played with. Now, to be fair, a couple of months ago, Abbott did extend the period for early voting. So someone could say that, and that's fine. But why limit it to this extent if you don't have any evidence of voter fraud? If there's other means by which you can make sure people aren't voting twice or doing stuff like that, then you should do that instead of a month out, you know, limiting where people can go to drop off their ballots. It's just not how we should be conducting ourselves at this moment when the trust in our institutions is already so low. When the trust in the process that's going to go into this election is already so low, leaders should not be adding to that. I think our responsibility, I think for Republicans, is to call this kind of stuff out. Look, let's not do this, because even if we don't have bad intentions, right, it doesn't look good. And that should be called out. And I think all Christians should, you know, do what we can. And we'll be coming up with something in the next few weeks to help Christians say, hey, this is how you can get involved. And so we should all be involved in that process. And I think if you're in that party in this particular instance and you live in Texas, you should call that out. That's not something that should happen, especially given the history of voting rights and the suppression of voting in America.
Yeah, it's just so important. But Justin, I think that's all for this episode. Appreciate talking with you as always. I would encourage folks to go to iTunes, leave a review of this podcast. It's been so wonderful to see our audience is grown for this podcast. We're hearing from y'all that these episodes, especially over the last few months, have been helpful to you, and we're grateful for you listening and that you trust us with your time. Justin, any closing thoughts, words before we wrap this up?
Yeah, I just reiterate what you said. Look, we appreciate your support. The only way that this movement, the AND campaign, grows, the podcast grows, is through you telling other people. So tell some of your friends at your church, some of the folks in your faith groups about what we're trying to do with the AND campaign and about the church. Church Politics Podcast. We would greatly appreciate it. And as usual, as I always say, AND Camp, there's a cross that neither political conservatism nor progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ, AND Camp. Until next time. Came out of Nazareth. This is the groove. Tell me, can you handle it? I'm schooled in the ways of runaway slaves. I'm brave. I'm unchained. I'm Frederick Douglass with a fame.